You're listening to the Yacht Racing Life podcast, the show for racing sailors everywhere. Featuring exclusive stories and interviews from across the world of competitive sailing. Hosted by British sailing journalist Justin Chisholm. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone. I'm Justin Chisholm, welcoming you to another episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast, where I'm joined this time by American athlete John Kroom. John had an illustrious career as a track cyclist in the US national team before switching sports to bring his physique and fitness to bear in the America's Cup, where he raced as a cyclor aboard the New York Yacht Club American Magic AC75 at the 38th America's Cup in Barcelona last year. During what turned out to be a wide-ranging and fast-paced interview, we find out how John tried football and wrestling before he finally became hooked on cycling, as well as taking a deep dive into his time with American Magic to discover what life is really like for an America's Cup cyclor. So John Kroom, welcome to the Yacht Racing Life podcast. It's been a while since we caught up back in Barcelona when you were in full cyclor mode with at the American Magic team. How's life been since the Cup?
Yeah, good, man. It's good to be on a podcast. I never thought I'd be on the Yacht Racing Life podcast. You know, I've been on a few podcasts myself, but nothing to do with yachting. So it's pretty cool, and I'm excited to be here.
So you were in Barcelona with your family for quite a while. Let's start with that. How did you enjoy Barcelona, that whole experience in Barcelona?
Well, we're missing it a little bit. We're here in sunny San Diego right now, which is cool. But man, Barcelona was a great experience for me and my wife and my dog. And we had a blast. We were there for a little over, I don't know, 18 months or so. And yeah, it's something that we'll kind of never forget. And it'll always kind of have a weird place of home in our heart, which is pretty cool. But yeah, it was great.
So let's start with your background. You're known as a cyclist. We know you through sailing as a cyclor, but I also saw in a little Wikipedia write-up that you had a football and a wrestling element to your sporting career. Tell me about both of those.
Yeah, no, I was always a big kid. I don't know. I would never necessarily say I was an athlete, though. But we just, you know, in America, and you know, football is a big sport, and wrestling can be pretty big here as well. And so I was, you know, I guess, you know, 305 pounds. I didn't really have many other sports I could play. And so I was straight into football and then straight into heavyweight wrestling throughout high school. But never really competitive. It was just like, it was more or less something for me to do. And something for me to, and kind of, yeah, it's like kind of just, you know, let out some energy during high school, I guess, and middle school.
What was family life like for John Kroom? Where did you grow up? What did your parents do? Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have two brothers. And we grew up in Rock Hill, South Carolina, which is a smaller town outside of Charlotte, North Carolina. About, you know, I guess for the sailors on the podcast, we're probably like 3 hours away from Charleston, South Carolina. And so, yeah, grew up there. And then throughout then, I, you know, went to college in Asheville, North Carolina in the mountains. Yeah, I just kind of spent most of my time in the Carolinas before cycling.
What did you study when you went to university?
Literally, I just picked something. I know. I was just like, I went to university so I could ride my bike. I studied sports rec management. I didn't really have a schooling background, which is funny because it kind of plays into the America's Cup selection process for me. But I didn't really study anything. I wouldn't say of value, but anything that I really needed to go to school for. Like, I think the most useful thing I got out of school, like out of college, was CPR certification, which I ended up having to use while I was in college, which was an interesting, wild story. But yeah, that I studied sports rec management, which is like how to run a facility, how to run a sports team, how to do social media, like basic, like business kind of stuff. And then I minored in psychology and business.
Now, you know, I've got to ask you to tell the story of the CPR. Did you save whoever it was?
Unfortunately, it did not work. I came in late and, you know, it was, I was, I don't know, 20, 19. And I just got done racing collegiate national championships. And most colleges don't have a lot of money. And so they send you on the worst flights possible. And so we had this like red eye flight out of Colorado Springs. It was like, I don't know, midnight, and it was going to be like a 4-hour flight. You know, most of those flights, when they kick off, like by the time once you're off after takeoff, lights are out. Well, the lights came on and I had gotten woken up, and I looked back and there's just a man sitting in the aisle, and I was like, man, that's odd. And then I kind of go back to sleep, look back again, and now I see that there's people doing CPR, people kind of freaking out a bit. And the thing that we learned in CPR is if you know CPR, you need to go and let people know that you know, and they can refuse your help. But if you don't let them know that you have it, and so I'm like battling in my head, do I go back there? Do I not go back there? And sure enough, I just go back there. I let the guys know. They were super calm, and they were just like, oh, yeah, no, I think we're good. And I go back to the front, and this lady comes running up, and she's like, they need you. And I'm like, okay. I come back there, and then I ended up in a CPR rotation with an ex-Marine, a EMT, an ex-sheriff, and a firefighter. And it was like almost textbook. Like, I mean, the guy, you know, unfortunately he passed, but if he could have had any better help, those four dudes were so highly qualified. And like, I was learning a different level of CPR in that process, but like, I was in the rotation, and it was a wild experience. And those were great dudes and super helpful. And but yeah, it was wild. That's my CPR story on an airplane.
Yeah, it's a good skill to know about for sure. And I know whenever there's offshore racing, big races, you know, that's part of the crew, you know, has to have some of that experience on board. So I think it'll serve you well. Hopefully you don't have to use it again, but it's good. So listen, tell me about the transition from those other sports into cycling. The thing, you know, you said you went to college just so you could cycle. So it sounds like this sport really grabbed you at some point. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, honestly, I don't know, man. I think I've been like super lucky. When I was in high school and college, I like I said, I wasn't really athletic. Like, I didn't really have like an athletic dream, but I was overweight. And yeah, I got into riding a bike. My parents were doing triathlons, and so like I started doing triathlons, but like I was always a little overweight, to a point where it's like, hey, you know, like you really need to like check yourself, you know, like if the path you're going down. My dad was like a jiu-jitsu, like, you know, not UFC fighting. I don't know. He had this like, his is like martial arts background. And so he's always like relatively super fit.
A ninja.
Yeah, like pretty much like a ninja. I mean, like he was like so fit. There was like, he had to do like a class where he had to be able to do a split with like two chairs. Like he'd put his feet on these like two chairs. And it was the weirdest thing. I thought it was the most wild thing. But my dad, his martial arts background was like pretty impressive, like black belt, I think like second degree. And yeah, so he was pretty heavy on the fitness when I was young. And I just loved video games and Cheetos, I guess. But anyways, I fell in love with riding a bike just because like my friends did it. We could just get around places. It was actually kind of exhilarating as well with the cars. I know that sounds really weird. I've kind of grown out of that exhilarating part, but I had so much fun like watching and growing up and watching MASH, which is this like fixed gear New York messenger bike crew. And they ride these like fixed gear bikes all over the city. And I grew up just watching them ride through the city. And it was also like, it was just like watching a very like soft video of these guys just like weaving in and out of traffic, doing crazy things, like bouncing off cars in the downtown streets of New York. And it's like, I just thought it was so cool. And anyways, I started racing a bike, and they built the velodrome in Rock Hill, South Carolina, and I started racing and fell in love with bike racing, and it like grabbed me almost instantly. And a guy once told me, he was like, look, you're way too big to be racing a bike. And I was like, no. And I was like, I think I was like 280 pounds at this time, because I had like shedded some weight from high school. And I ended up losing like another 80 pounds in racing a bike. Yeah, we ended up moving to Colorado Springs. I got my first phone call to move to Colorado Springs to race with the U.S. national team. And I raced with the U.S. national team pretty much all the way through Tokyo. And we didn't make it to Tokyo. But then I started to like have this like kind of battle of like, well, what am I going to try to go for Paris? Do I need to get a real job? Like any Olympic sport, it's hard. You're playing the national governing body. You're playing age. Yeah, I don't really come from money. I don't come from support. Like I'm still paying off my Olympic debt, which kind of goes into getting a real job with American Magic. And then I promised my wife. My wife sacrificed a lot. Like in 2022, I believe, or the end of 2021, I had a hard conversation with the national team. That was just like, if you know, you're 28 years old, we don't really see us supporting you to Paris. And I said, well, fine, I'll just go to Paris on my own. Like I'll just do it. And so I told my wife, like, if I knew I wasn't going to go to Paris, I'd get a real job. Like, and I would kind of know based off qualification that, by the end of 2022, I'd kind of have a little bit of an idea. But yeah, then 3 weeks later, after having that heavy conversation with my wife, I get kind of a random phone call asking me if I've ever sailed on boats before. And my answer was no. I'm in a landlocked, you know, state in the U.S. They're asking me if I can do these crazy power numbers, and I'm like doing the math in my head, and I'm like, none of this makes sense. And I kind of thought it was a scam. And so like we went back and forth for a little while of like getting me to come out and trial. And I think they were actually getting fed up with it too. Like, I was just kind of annoyed. And so like, I kind of just like pushed it off, because I didn't really know what the America's Cup was. I didn't understand why they would call me. What blew my mind, because in cycling, we have so many people that try to come into the sport without trying to learn the sport, and they fail every time. They try to buy their way through the sport, and it just doesn't go very well. And so what I didn't want to do is like come into somebody's sport, not even knowing it. And you're like, people are like trying to tell me this is the highest level of the sport. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, why would you bring me in? Like, I'm literally telling you, I know nothing about sailing. And come to find out, there was more to it than that. And that's what was really cool and sold me. I eventually ended up going because I was in Belgium and I had a bad race and I needed a plane ticket from Canada or from the US to Canada. And I pretty much called them. I was like, hey, if I come, will you at least fly me to the World Cup? And they're like, yeah, we can fly you to the World Cup, but we can't fly you back from the World Cup. Like, cause they were going to fly me from my house, Colorado, to come do the test. But then the next week I needed a plane ticket to get to the World Cup. So I just like, you know what, I'll go do a 20-minute test or whatever test they want me to do, just so I can get a plane ticket so I can race a World Cup. And so I do it. I get there and I meet the guys and I'm immediately hooked. Like immediately hooked. Like I meet the crew, I meet the coaches. It was just like, it was almost just like everything I was looking for in cycling refreshed. And yeah, I was pretty much hooked and fell in love with it. Like the, you know, right when I got in. And so flew to the World Cup, didn't go very hot. And pretty much my eyes were set on training for the America's Cup.
The America's Cup remains the pinnacle of world sailing and one of the hardest trophies in international sport to win. But where and how did it all start? Magnus Wheatley, a lifelong chronicler and follower of the America's Cup, decided to open the archives and find out. What he discovered in his book, There Is No Second, is a refreshed look at that very first race around the Isle of Wight on August 22nd, 1851. Magnus goes deep, starting the book with the Marquess of Anglesey at the Battle of Waterloo and his subsequent purchase of what was then an unremarkable trophy from the Panton Street showroom of the Crown Jewellers R&S Garrard. However, the crux of the book is the revealing of the name of the signalmaster on board the royal yacht Victoria and Albert that took 2 years of forensic journalism involving the Royal and Naval Archives and the National Archives in Kew. It's compelling reading. There Is No Second is billed as the definitive account of that first race in 1851 for what would become the America's Cup. It's a must-read for anyone with an interest in the great game of the Cup, written by an author at his very peak. Order today on Amazon.com. So were these guys, were they being coy about why they wanted you? Did they explain about the cyclo thing, or were they kind of, I guess at that stage, they were trying to keep that whole thing a secret?
Nothing was really a secret. It was really funny. Like, I was actually like wondering what I could talk about. Like, it was really weird. Like, I think like on the first conversation, there was like, it was pretty wide open. It was like, hey, you know, we need cyclists for this, this, that, and the other. And I watched a couple of videos, which by the way, like trying to find videos on this stuff is really hard to find. Like you can't really like, or anybody to explain it to you. And so like, I'm looking around trying to understand it. They weren't very like reserved on it because I think they were still learning it, if that makes sense. Like they were still trying to figure it out as well. So they're like trying to tell me what they think they know. And I'm trying to understand what they think they know, if that makes any sense. So like some of the power numbers that they're throwing out are just like models that they've posted inside of. They're trying to like, I guess, divide the power that was needed to sail Patriot 1. By four, you know, when it took eight guys to grind on that boat. And so they're just like, they're kind of going. And so like the numbers are kind of all over the place. At that time, we didn't know we were going to go recumbent. Nobody had even really talked about it. At the moment that I got the phone call, it was really like, hey, we just need cyclists and we don't really know who, but we just know that we need cyclists. And then they kind of realized that they needed rowers, which is kind of like a funny turn of events. It was pretty wide open, actually. It was actually like it starts getting like as we started getting hired and like plugged in, that's when it kind of started like becoming a bit hush hush. NDAs are signed, kind of becomes a little bit more secretive.
Yeah. I just want to jump back to that phone call. Who made the phone call to you originally? Who was it?
The first phone call I had, I don't remember his name. First phone call I had was a professor. The first phone call I had was a coach from Ben Sharp. I think he was interviewing for the position at the time. And he was just telling me about it. And he was just like, hey, what do you think it'll take for you to change sports? And I get these like random phone calls all the time. And I kind of just like threw out a number. And he's like, I kind of think they might do that. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I got another phone call from like a random professor out of a university that got my phone number. And he wanted to know my power data. And because he wanted to like, because he thought that they needed like tier-end riders from the track. And he was like, I was the only American he could find that was like the size that they wanted. And he wanted to know all my power numbers and my power data and like this, that, and the other. And I was like, oh, okay. I mean, I don't really care. There's nothing really you can do with my power data. And then he was asking me if I'd be interested in doing it. And I was like, well, look, like I'd really like to talk to somebody from the actual team. Because at this point, I'm just getting these random phone calls. And then I got a call from Baden Cashmore, who's like the head of performance over there. And we talked for like an hour plus on it all. And that's kind of how it went from there. And then met Terry Hutchinson shortly thereafter.
It still boggles my mind that you guys came in, you know, really knowing nothing about the cup. And it just entertains me, the thought of you gradually working it out as you're like, oh, you want us to do this, you know? Because they were saying to you, basically, you're going to be powering the boat, right? They were telling you that much.
Yeah, but I didn't even, like, I mean, I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, you know what I mean? Sometimes I need to, like, touch things, feel things, and see things. Like, you can explain it to me. It's just going to go in one ear and out the other. And so, like, it, like, took me a while to kind of, like, process, like, oh, that's what a tack is. Oh, that's what a jibe is. Okay, we're bearing away. Okay, this is what's happening when all of that is happening. Okay, I understand. Like, and because they're moving so fast, like, I couldn't really grasp it. But, like, one thing that was really cool about the entire cup is, like, I would say 98% of the people were stoked that we were there. Like, and what was crazy to me is that like everybody was really, really excited to have us around. Everybody was really excited to teach us if we had questions. Like it was wild to me. I don't think any other sport would be like that at the highest of levels, but it just kind of shows you that these teams and these programs will do whatever it takes to win. Like if they think they have to bring in somebody that knows nothing about sailing to power the boat, because that's what it's going to take to win. And they're going to have to teach them how to sail. I mean, think about it. Like think about a person who's been sailing their entire life and knows everything about the America's Cup. And like, no matter how good the person is athletically, like it would kind of hurt a little bit to see those guys on the boat. You know what I mean? I would think. And so to have that opportunity and then have these people be so humble and so willing to teach us, like, was unreal. And I mean, you know, hats go off to like Trevor Bird, Cooper Dressler, Tim Hornsby, three dudes who are like, you know, some of the best grinders, you know, in the world, if not, you know, the US, right? Like these guys, these guys took the time to teach us everything they could in a crash course about sailing. And were super patient with us. And you know, yeah, there was times where I bet they got frustrated. But I mean, in the grand scheme of things, like I would say that, like, those guys, again, they did whatever it took for them to win. And what's crazy is, right, like, those guys actually knew how to sail. These guys are sailing on, like, some of the biggest boats in the world. And, you know, there's a chance they may not sail in the America's Cup because they don't have enough power. And then they're teaching the guys that are going to sail ahead of them how to sail. And they didn't even blink an eye. They just did it. And so, like, I don't know, man. I just gained a lot of respect through the whole process of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know I do. And it's a really good point because I completely get it, what you're saying about people have worked their whole lives to be part of an America's Cup team, and then in comes a bunch of guys who are more powerful but don't know anything about sailing. But I think that's very typical of the America's Cup mentality, because it is the ultimate team sport in sailing, because you can't worry about yourself in all of this. You have to be all the time thinking about the team. Easy to say, hard to do.
Yeah, I think that's my thing, right? Like, I think there's two things to that. Like, going back to the people that, you know, will probably, like, there's some sailors out there that might not ever get a chance to sail in the America's Cup and have wanted to do it their entire lives. And, like, honestly, those are the guys that I race for. And that's, like, I may never, ever sail again. I may never, ever do the America's Cup again. But while I was there, they were the people I was thinking about, because I knew how I felt when I was a cyclist and I was missing a few opportunities because, you know, they were wanting to give somebody younger a chance, or they were wanting to give somebody in the world tour a chance. And I just kind of missed an opportunity here or there. Yeah. I just kind of made sure that I worked my ass off, like, did everything I could to learn, to support every department in a way that, like almost worked to a point where I wasn't just an athlete anymore. Like, I was, like, you know, sweeping the sail loft floor or scrubbing up hydraulic oil down in the hull, like, doing whatever I could to support every department more than just, you know, more than just being an athlete. And I did that out of kind of a bit of respect for, you know, the people that would do whatever it took to be there. You know what I mean? And yeah, it honestly helped me be where I'm at today, which is really cool, because I really wanted to stay in the industry. But, like, I was leaving Barcelona wondering if I'd ever get to step foot on a boat again.
I think that ethos, whether you're a cyclo or just anybody in a team, in any team, America's Cup team, an ocean race team, any sort of sailing team, that is the ethos that really works, is, you know, just work as hard as you can, be as helpful as you can, be as useful as you can to the team. So I can see why that would endear you to the team. Now, I want to go back to the power side of things, because you've talked quite a lot about they were asking you for numbers, and were the numbers they were asking you for within the range of what you were already able to produce, or were they kind of a stretch goal?
They had a weird test that they wanted to do that was, like, it would have had us averaging, like, 700 watts for 20 minutes, like, based off the different variability of the test. And so it was, like, you know, a certain sprint for a certain amount of time, back down to threshold for a certain amount of time, it would have been, like, 700, because, like, I don't want to give the full test protocol.
Yeah.
But long story short, it would have been 750 watt average, like, when I plugged it into a computer, because, right, like, you can do the math on it. Like, if you want me to average this amount of watts for this amount of seconds, you can plug it all into Training Peaks and see how much that would be. And it was 750 watts. And I was like, that's not possible. they wanted a guy. It was weird because they were like, we think we want a guy that can do 400 watts for 20 minutes. And I was like, oh, that's no problem. I think I did like 430 watts for 20 minutes on the first test. And then I went and did some racing and went to the second test. And this is the, and I, at this point, I don't know what anybody's done. And they were like, they called me and they're like, hey, that was a great test. We'd like you to come for, you know, the second one. And I'm like, my ego is through the moon right now. Like, I'm thinking, like, I'm just going to smash these fools. Like, it's like, none of these guys have ever ridden a bike. Like, I'm hearing the grinders aren't even like cracking like 350. Like, I'm just going to go smash these guys. And it was at this time, like, there was no grinders at this one. Like, none of the old guys from the last cup. It was just the new guys getting recruited. And I get in there, do the 30-second test, and I'm, like, watching everybody on their bike. And I'm like, wow, these guys are all over the place. Like, there's no way there's actual power coming from their foot into the pedal. And then the test results get released. And it's like, okay, 30-second, you know, I was second, like, second best. And I'm like, what? Should have been first. And then, I think it was like a four-minute run. And I was like second or third. And I was like, what? I should have been the, what the heck? Like, and then, like, I look at the 20-minute and I was dead last. And I was like, oh, man, I'm in for a world of hurt, which I've never really been good at 20-minute tests. But when I was watching those guys flail all over their bikes, I was like, oh, man, like, if those guys somewhat get a little bit better at just holding their position on their bike, they're going to be like going through the moon on power, which they eventually did. And it's like, those guys had so much room for growth because they had never done it before. You know what I mean? So
these,
like,
were the rowers.
Yeah. And they, like, and the same with the grinders, right? Like, none of them have ever really done it before. So, like, any number that they flopped out early days, you can go ahead and expect like a 20% increase. Whereas like guys with like me and Ashton who've been doing it for like 10, 12 years, it's like, we're like starting to see a little bit of our peak on the cycling side of things. You know what I mean? And we were just hoping to God that they wouldn't figure that out. and we just like, we kept just working at it. Like, we did everything we could to be the best that we could. But I maybe increased like, I don't know, 5%. I was actually just still impressed that I was able to do the watts I was able to do with working the amount that I worked, like, and being on my feet the amount I was on my feet. Like, when I was a pro cyclist, like, I would never go to work after training. Like, I would do like a 5-hour ride and then like come into work and start helping, you know, I don't know, flake sales or help with a little bit of rigging or, you know, help with hydraulics or cleaning the gym. I don't know, doing something. And so I would never do that. I would like come home and eat food and watch Netflix and go to sleep. And, it was just a different kind of lifestyle, but yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Hi everybody. Justin Chisholm here with a quick message. We do hope you're enjoying this episode of the Yacht Racing Live podcast, and we wanted you to know that you can get more great content from around the world of sailboat racing on the Yacht Racing Live website. There's plenty of free content to check out, and premium subscribers get all areas access to the site. Head over to yachtracinglife.com/YRL pod for a lifetime 50% off the regular monthly premium subscription price. Yeah, you certainly took to it. Now, the cyclists and the rowers, tell me, you made a comment earlier, it turns out they were really looking for rowers. What's the difference between a rower and a cyclist in terms of physique?
I think most rowers are just going to tend to be on that 100 kg side. Like, all the cyclists that they interviewed were too light, except for me. I was a bit of an anomaly. There was a few guys that were bigger, but they still had to gain weight. Whereas the rowers were like perfect weight. And then the rowers, I think the rowers just have this like different, they have a different like gear. I don't think they've ever like done a recovery ride or a coffee ride. Like if they're gonna do a recovery, they're not training. But if they're gonna train, they're like I don't know, they could like push lactate through their ears. Like they can just recruit muscles that I didn't even know I had to produce power. And they don't care how they look, what they're doing. They just like watts through a system and they just make it happen. And so like I've always had a high level of respect for those guys and the kind of the sixth zone that those guys can enter and the dark hole that they can put themselves in, because it's unreal, man. Like it's unreal. But yeah, I think they were kind of leaning more towards the rowers, partially because it's like those guys came out of a package doing insane watts, just like out of nowhere. Like the guys had no, like not all of them. Some of them had a little bit of a cycling background, like in riding, but like some of the guys, like they'd never done less than 400 plus watts for 20 minutes. Like that was easy to them, you know? And so, whereas like for most cyclists, like getting 400 watts for 20 minutes is like pretty impressive at a pro level. And now mind you, that's it's kind of increasing now, but mind you, that's like with riding the bike on a road, doing turns, yeah, things like that. So it kind of changes the game a little bit. Like when you're stationary, it's a bit different, but yeah, no, I think that's kind of why they lean towards rowers a little bit. The other thing is too, and this is like kind of going back to that earlier comment about education, they wanted engineers. They wanted people who could draw and design, and pretty much every rower we had, I think, came from an engineering background. And so that kind of played a little bit into the selection, is that they kind of thought they would have these guys designing
on the, like helping on the design side with the boat, or designing the cyclo kit?
A mixture, like the cyclo kit, things on the boat, you know, even if it was just like little things, whether it's fairings or what have you. And so when I found that out, I literally took a YouTube class on how to draw like 3D print stuff. And so I did like a 30 day learn how to draw on Fusion 360 just so I could say I can do it.
yeah. Did they ever get you to do it?
Yeah, I had to draw up pins for the FCS foil cylinders. So when we took the foil wings out, we would essentially put these pins in to hold the hydraulic rams on. And so those were made by me.
Cool. I like that story. We never picked that one up in the recon interviews we did.
Yeah, no, I know. I always had to be a little coy in those recon interviews. And then I just sometimes would even just take the piss. They were a lot of fun.
I remember.
Supposedly, I was a highlighted talk at the AC bar every once in a while, which is good.
You were always entertaining. It was a little frustrating at times for us doing the recon, but... We were all playing a game, of course, at that point.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I do remember you talking about in one of the interviews was the difference between, and you've just alluded to it, the difference between developing power on a bike on the road and developing power on something that is just, you know, there's no, you can't generate any momentum to it.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I think it's like still hard to like explain, but it's very like, I mean, with these pumps and the hydraulic fluid, it's really hard to build up and pressurize, and then as you're pressurizing, you're like trying to figure out all the shift points on the pump and this, that, and the other. It was hard to train. Like, we just didn't know how to train it well. Now, mind you, the more power we had, the easier it was. But at the same time, I think it kind of all flips back to sailing. And this is one thing that frustrated me with the whole process is, like, and it kind of hurts me, if I'm being honest. You know, I went sailing with those guys the first time that they ever had the bike system on because I helped set it up. And when I did it, I was like, you don't need us. You need sailors. Like, you need guys who know, they need to know when to pedal. And that was like the first thing I said. And because it's like, I can pedal. I have all the power in the world, I guess, but I don't know when to or why to. And when you're just pedaling for pedal's sake, especially on a hydraulic pump like that, it can really mess things up, and it can really set you up for failure. And so, yeah, I think for us, it was really a lot of like learning the whens, learning the hows and the whys for us to pedal. And then how hard do we pedal? Do we need to pedal super hard? Do we not need to pedal super hard? Like, and those kind of things, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. So do you think there was a big change in technique, if we want to call it that, between when you started and when you finished?
Yeah, I mean, there had to be, right? Like, I mean, we ended up doing like practically like sailing 101 classes where, like, you know, you'd have a sailor or you'd have someone set up a class for us to learn a topic and understand a topic. I mean, hell, like, there was like, we were like going into races, or like there was times where we were about to go into races where some guys didn't even know how long a race was. What was the race? Like, are we winning? Are we losing? Like, it was a bit rough.
Yeah.
But it's kind of one of those things where, like, again, I go back to those guys and like the patience that, like, you know, Goody, Slingers, Michael Menninger, all those guys had with us is unreal.
But you're part of the team, so you know team's only as strong as its weakest link. So if that's a weakness in the link, then they're going to want to fix it, right?
For sure. But it's crazy to me they brought the link on.
Like, yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, yeah. It's like you're only strongest as your weakest link. Yeah, I understand that, but like these guys knew what they were getting themselves into. Like, they could have easily, you know, just trained up some of the guys from the 36 Cup on bikes and called it good. And yeah, so that was like one of those things that kind of like played its way out, if that makes sense.
The decision to go recumbent was made pretty early by the team, based on what we've had Goody on the podcast and Tom Burnham on the podcast recently. And, you know, I asked him about this. So it was a pretty early call because it was fundamental to the design of the boat, this very low freeboard, sleek-looking boat that they were going to build. When they first told you, yeah, oh, and by the way, we're going to go recumbent, what was your reaction?
Well, like, the conversation came up a few times, and I was just like, we're going to lose power. We're going to lose a lot of power, and it might not... Like, we need to know how much power we're going to lose versus the aero gain that we're going to gain. And that was just my thing. So, like, coming from a cycling background, you have CDA. There's, like, you know, just, like, basic coefficients of drag. And so you want to get small enough to where you're moving at speed through, you know, you're breaking through faster, right? You want to get small enough. You're breaking through that air faster, but there's a crossover, like where you get too small to where you start to affect power production. And then the crossover, then, you know, we called it watts per CDA, whereas like usually you would have watts per kilo. So like if you were climbing, it'd be like watts based off your weight, like the lighter you are and the more watts you produce, in theory, you will go up the hill faster, right? So the more watts you could produce over a smaller CDA, it would, in theory, mean that you were faster in aero, right? And so that was just my call. There was like a few, you know, a few designers were really hesitant because they thought, well, maybe people would hold back on the test because they really wanted to ride upright. Like there was a few, they were just people worried that like, because it was just such a stink on the potential that we might go recumbent, people thought they wouldn't actually put their best foot forward. And maybe, I don't know, but like, we also like, we had no time to train on a recumbent and we just like came in and did a recumbent test.
Yeah.
Now, mind you, when we did it, there wasn't, I think it was like a 10% drop off or something like that. Like it wasn't that crazy. Now there's several things that you can kind of think about on this stuff. Like, you know, when we entered the cup, we were the fittest we've ever been, all of us. And now you could take that same thing and say, well, what if you trained upright continuously? Would you have like, you know, been 5% even more fit? I don't know. Like, right. You're maybe, but we had more than enough. Like we had more power than we had upright entering racing in right. August 2022.
Right. Because yeah. Because you trained at it specifically to maximize the potential.
Exactly. And yeah, so we knew about recumbents pretty early, and it was funny, man, because we were like constantly like hiding our trainers and moving things around, like because we knew recon was going to be there. Like we had to be careful when we were like, you know, bitching about it on chase boats with recon there. There was like all these kinds of things that we like, there was just like this constant, like, you know, we had to be careful going out to the bars and talking about it because we kind of thought every team was going to do it. And like, I think that was like part of the thing. It was like, well, we think every team's going to do it anyway. We kind of should try to look at heading that way and hedging that way. And I want to say, I think Alinghi looked at it and they didn't feel like the power transfer was worth it.
Yeah. I mean, from what I can gather from the conversations I've had, everybody looked at it and I don't think it was dismissed out of hand. I think it was considered pretty seriously, but in the end, you were the only guys who did it. But as per the other podcast interviews I've done, I don't get the feeling that you were suffering for power. And you've just said that you had a little bit more power than when you started with the upright. So,
no, I don't think we were suffering for power. I don't think that was the issue. Now, I might be a biased individual, but I don't think that was the issue. And this is where I go back to, if I could change one thing that I feel like I could make better about the America's Cup, is I would learn everything I could about hydraulic systems. Like I would just study and study and like pathways and pump profiles and everything. And I would test it. And yeah, that's something that I feel like, you know, when I go back and be like, hey, you don't really need us, you really need like the grinders. I feel like some of those guys just have experiences from different boats that maybe you could have played in. Like when your first and only boat is American Magic, like I'm literally like going like, oh yeah, this is what we did on Patriot One. Should we do this here? And it's like, no, we probably shouldn't. We probably should try to do something different, something better. But like, what is different? What is better? I don't know. Like I've never yeah. done it. And that was like the hardest thing for me, honestly. And that's kind of, you know, why I'm at where I'm at today. But it's like, it was really hard for me because like, I felt like I was almost like, person that was forgetting their name. Like I was just like constantly standing there like I want to do something but I can't do anything, and I kind of know where I feel like we're lacking, and where I feel like where I would want to be of help would be in the systems, but I just couldn't help because I didn't have that brain to provide it. And we had some of the smartest guys in the world doing the system stuff. And so like when I'm saying that I wanted to be able to help that, I mean, it would really just be there to be supportive of them because, you know, those guys just, you know, you never have enough guys, like you never have enough people and you can never do everything that you want to do. And I feel like if they would have had just one more person, then maybe they could have tested some things that they couldn't have tested. Yeah. And I could have done that.
Are you interested in advertising your product or service on the Yacht Racing Life podcast? It's really simple. Go to yachtracinglife.com/advertising to find out how. Did you have a lot of input, or did they ask a lot of you in terms of feedback on the systems?
Yeah, they did. I mean, again, though, like, what do you know? Hey, this feels weird. Well, what are you comparing it to? I don't know.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Yeah. And that's what I would go back to. Like, it's like, well, how did it feel today? And you're trying to give educated answers without sounding like a dickhead. But at the same time, it's like, I don't want to bullshit and change things and not know. And then so, yeah, it's crazy because like if I went back, like I would know so much, right? And or at least know a lot more than I thought I ever would. And like, it's crazy to look at where I was, you know, when I first walked through the door and when I exited, you know, Barcelona. So
yeah,
it was cool. Cause like, I was just like constantly learning and constantly trying to figure it out. And yeah, if I could go back, like it's just like, I think system wise, it's just something that testing more things.
Yeah,
it's not as easy as just a bike chain and a crankset and some pumps, right? Like it's
yeah.
There's some more to it.
I think I'm really pleased we're doing this podcast interview because we're getting into stuff that, because of the secret nature of the cut, we could never get into. You know, certainly not in recon, and not even just a journalist asking you these questions. You couldn't give that stuff away. And that means that people, I think, did make the mistake of looking at the cyclos and saying, well, what are they doing on the boat? You know, they don't have any background in sailing, and here they are in the America's Cup. But it's a fascinating story that this team of people and all of the stuff that they had to learn and all of the changes you had to make to yourselves and your bodies and the way you operated and to be just doing a completely new sport. Like if you were doing a documentary series, that's a full episode just on that.
Yeah. No, it was cool, man. And honestly, like sailing saved my life in a weird way. And maybe that's a bit dramatic, but it's like I was lost, man. I literally was having a conversation with my wife about finding a real job and this, that, and the other, and like quitting cycling, which is all I knew at the time, and it's all I dedicated my life to. And then I found this real job, which happened to be the America's Cup, and knew nothing about it. And it was like a big job fair for me. Like I got to hang out in the sail loft. I got to hang out in the hydraulic container, the rigging container, you know, a little bit of design, the 2D plotter. Like I got to do all this stuff, and they, you know, they paid me to be there to be an athlete and go sailing. But then at the same time, I got to learn all these crazy cool skills and be a part of such an amazing team and program. It changed my life. Like I owe a lot to Terry Hutchinson and Tyson Lamond and Doug DeVos and Hatfoff and that whole program. Because like, if it wasn't for that program, I'd probably be selling bike parts out of a bike shop or something. I don't know, like just not knowing what to do with my life. And now I've like gotten this whole new sporting and career ahead of me.
Let's talk about that because, you know, I've been following you on social media and you're a sailor now, right? You're a sailor.
I think we still have to say it with loose terms, but But yeah, I went sailing this weekend, actually. Even did an offshore race here in San Diego. And so I'm sailing with two programs this season and in a few random boats here and there.
Tell us about the two programs. What are they?
Yeah, so one's an offshore program here out of San Diego that'll be doing Transpac, and it's on a Kerr 51. And that's been a whole new experience for me because it's such a light crew. I'm having to learn pretty quick because I'm doing kind of a mixture of roles. And, you know, when it comes to offshore racing, especially the way that these guys have it set up, everybody kind of does everything in intervals. And so, but I'm mainly doing the grinding position and the pit position. And so offside pit. And so that's kind of my main role. But yeah, that's kind of the goal with that program. And then I'll be sailing with WindQuest in the GL52s with Terry Hutchinson and Doug DeVos and those guys, which is really exciting. And I'm really excited to do.
Doesn't hurt to stay involved with that little group of people, huh?
I just don't know if it's just because I bugged Terry so much. I've like pretty much told Terry, I was like, I'm going to go sailing. I'm going to do everything I can to go sailing. And he's like, if I have something, I'll call you. And I was like, okay, don't forget about me, Terry. And I have this like ongoing joke with all the guys when we were leaving. I was like, hey, look, I need you to promise me one thing, that I'm the 10th grinder. And they're like, or no, the 11th grinder. That's what it is. And so like Kyle Langford would call me number 11 every once in a while. I was just like, I just need to be the 11th guy that you call. So once you go through your top 10 grinders, then you can call me. And so, yeah, like I love it, man. I love the people. I love the industry. I love it all, man. It's been a blast. And so I'm doing that. And then when I'm not sailing, I'm working out of a canvas shop here in San Diego, Harden Up Yachting, and make mainsail covers and bags and hang out on Shelter Island in Point Loma. It's pretty cool. I enjoy
it. That sounds fantastic. Was that skills that you learned during the Cup or?
A little bit, yeah. A good buddy of mine, Ben Newton, who you know very well. I got to hang out with him quite a bit working in the sail loft, and the sail loft has a special home in my heart, like just because those guys are some of the coolest dudes and a lot of fun. And I got to work and help build the sail loft in Barcelona, which then turned into me learning how to use the sewing machine, which then turned into me just kind of hanging around learning a few things here and there. And then shortly thereafter I was told that cyclists probably shouldn't be in the sail loft. and then I made my way over to the hydraulics container and met a few of my favorite Frenchmen in the world and hung out with the hydraulics container pretty much to the end of the Cup, and was changing FCS oil every night, which was quite an experience.
Yeah.
Benny taught me how to use the sewing machine, and the rest was kind of history on that. And it's been cool. So now I'm learning under Andrew Coates over at Harden Up and just hanging out, making bags and having a good time. It's I don't even know if it's really work. Like, I don't even know how much money I make or whatever. I just kind of go there, hang out and have a blast, hang out on some cool boats and do some cool stuff.
Yeah. Sounds like you're hanging out in all the right places. I've got to ask you, your experience of offshore sailing, how's that gone? Because it's very different to what you've been doing before.
Yeah, very different. I don't know. I'm kind of learning as we go. You know, two nights ago was my first experience, which we have some crazy stories and some crazy adventures already. Being woken up at 3 a.m. because we've hit something and need to back down and drop the kite, and you know, five guys on the bow holding this kite down, and then it's got to be rehoisted, and you know, you slept like an hour and a half, and you know, it's tired, downwind final leg for like, you know, 7 hours, and so you're grinding. I think I was grinding for almost, I was on the pedestal for almost 6 hours at the end and the finish. Yeah, it's pretty full on. But like I said, I felt the thing I was missing in the America's Cup is just like having those experiences, like the sailing experience. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, people think that there's, you know, the America's Cup's not really sailing, which I can see where they're coming from. But there's a lot of sailing that's used in that that would have been really helpful for me to know.
Yes.
And and so I'm kind of like backtracking. Kind of like I'm getting involved in all these programs and I'm sailing as much as I can. Like I think I might even go sail on a Swan 50, which will be like the first time I haven't, you know, I'll sail on a boat that doesn't need like human power. Like it's all electric winches and
cool.
And so, yeah. So I'm pretty excited. I mean, it's like getting these opportunities to be a part of these boats is pretty, pretty cool.
You're on the Yacht Racing Life podcast. It seems like you're embracing the yacht racing life pretty well.
I'm trying, man. Yeah, I'm doing everything I can. Like if I'm not sailing that weekend, I like just go find there's a 505 fleet out here in San Diego. I literally just like I messaged the guy and I was like, hey, would you mind if I just came and I'll be sporadic. Would you mind if I just came and sailed? So I started sailing a little bit on the 505s as well, which has been cool. It's the first time on a trapeze. And so that was pretty interesting. And so, yeah, I'm just trying to learn it all and get a taste of it all. And I don't know, maybe I'll get like so sick of it here by the end of the year just because I've like kind of overextended myself. But so far, so good.
I don't think it works like that with sailing, my friend. But so listen, an obvious question, John. Do you have another America's Cup in you?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I think my wife wants me to, which is kind of like the inverse, I would think, sometimes with some of these guys. But it kind of just depends how they go. You know what I mean? Like, if there's human power, I'm pretty much like a 98% yes, no matter what direction they go, whether it's grinders or cyclists or whatever. Assault bikes, I don't know what they'll think of. But yeah, like if they do human power, I'm really interested. If it goes battery, I would need to see if they would even want me, right? Because it'd probably be a short crew role of the sorts. But like I said, man, I have American Magic has a special home in my heart and like the cup in general. Like it's high performance at its finest. Like I would love to do another cup for sure. It just really depends on how it goes. I had an opportunity to potentially go work with the team with what they're doing down there right now, and things just didn't work out with the level of the sailing schedule that I have right now. But this is kind of what I want to be doing. I want to be sailing and I want to get all that out of my body before it's too late. And I don't know if I'll ever, again, I don't know if I'll ever have these opportunities again. So me turning down, you know, a trans pack or, you know, a GL52 to go do some short crew, I'm just not ready to do that yet. But yeah, I think there's part of me though that wants to keep learning these kind of skills because then that way, you know, I can still get plugged in later if I want to, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, well, I hope that answered your question very vaguely.
It does. I think you'd be back in a heartbeat if you get the opportunity. Yeah. And as you say, let's see what happens with the future of the human power on board these boats.
Yeah,
John, this has been fantastic. It's been a great insight into the cyclor role and into your involvement in the America's Cup. So thank you for spending the time with me. I appreciate it. I think we should follow up maybe after you've done the trans pack.
No, yeah, we should, man. Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. So here we go.
That should be a great experience. I'm kind of jealous that you're doing that. I've never done that race, so I'll be interested to hear how it goes for you. So listen, for now though, I'll just say thanks again and good luck with everything.
Thank you, man.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. We will be back soon with another top name interview, but in the meantime, check out yachtracinglife.com for more great content from across the sailing world.